And this segment, we are talking about Stand Up for Kindness and Erase Hate. I'd like to welcome Deborah Bryant. She is with the Santa Fe Public Schools Wellness Program, specializing in bully prevention, and Reverend Brandon Johnson of the United Church of Santa Fe. He's president of the Interfaith Leadership Alliance. And welcome back to the show, Shelley Manlev. She's also with the Santa Fe Public Schools Safe Schools and Healthy Student Program, and she's here talking about Erase Hate. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, everybody.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, Mary Charlotte.
It's a pleasure, as always. Shelley, you're always doing amazing programs in the public schools above and beyond the curriculum.
Well, it's a pleasure to get to do particularly this community and school event, because the issues we're talking about, bullying, hate, how we treat each other, extend far beyond our school community and really take a village, take an entire community to be committed to work towards.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about bullying for a moment. This is a phenomenon that I think we probably all know from our childhood. I certainly do. And one thing that's happened since perhaps all of us were in school, or the parents of the kids in today's public schools were in school, is that bullying has been studied and researched and written about and understood much more than it was before. What are we actually seeing? What do we know about bullying that we didn't used to know?
Well, I would say that in the schools, we have come to a how we define it. Because what's happening now is as bullying is such a buzzword, everything is being called bullying and it's actually not. So how we are defining bullying is bullying reflects an imbalance of power such that whoever is targeted feels they can't defend themselves. Bullying is repeated behavior, or there is a threat that it's repeated. The person feels like it will be. And it's intentional.
And it's not always punching. It can be online. It can be
It takes
verbal
many
threats,
forms.
Things like that.
Yeah, and of course we all know that cyberbullying has now added a big piece to how bullying is being played out.
And so what are you actually seeing? Like what are you seeing among the kids in the schools where you work?
Well, what I see really is I think that underneath the why, what I see a lot of is an inability to honor difference. Difference equates to inferior, equates to not worthy of my respect, which is really like having contempt. I mean, I think that's what we see a lot of. And so we're doing a lot of work on how can we encourage our students to honor differences and celebrate diversity.
What kind of differences are you talking about?
It can look many different things. It can be racial. It can still be gender. It can be intellectual capacity. Sometimes it can be our students with disabilities. But wherever there can be a perceived power differential.
And so you actually are seeing, for example, able-bodied students bullying disabled kids?
That does happen, but what also happens is students with disabilities also are bullying other students.
And what does that look like?
It can look like them picking on them, them being physical. It can look pretty much some of the same ways.
So it's not just the sort of lower group on the totem pole, so to speak.
No, but I think when we look at our world is role modeling in many different ways, bullying for our kids, because they've learned it. Okay, I guess the one thing I would like to ask everybody to do is in the schools, we really are asking everybody to think about people first language, that we talk about student who bullies rather than call somebody a bully, because we don't want to say it's who they are.
Right.
So that's a really important piece for us, that we're really asking us to change our languaging. That bullying is a behavior that can be changed as it is learned.
Now, again, just down to the specifics, are you seeing this in the hallways? Are you seeing it in the classrooms, on the playground?
Everywhere.
Give me some examples.
Well, one of the things that's really was really quite shocking to us is when we talked with teachers and asked them where they thought all the bullying was, they said, oh, it's in the hallways, it's on the playgrounds. But when we've done surveys of students, they say a lot of it happens in the classroom. So, and one of the things that I think has happened is many of our children have become rather clever about disguising it, that we may not even notice it.
So let's talk for a moment about the Erase Hate events. That is a program that is culminating in Judy Shepherd, mother of Matthew Shepherd, coming in and giving a talk at the Lensic on Tuesday, the 29th of January next week. And this is all about basically dealing with prejudice against gay and bisexual queer people.
Well, Erase Hate isn't all about that. That's part of what it's about. And, you know, the groups that Deborah mentioned, of course, are students with different sexual identity, gender expression, in many cases are often targeted and at risk for bullying. So Capital High actually last year decided to put on the Laramie Project. And for your listeners who are not familiar with the Laramie Project, it's an incredible play that was developed as a result of a group of actors going to visit Laramie, Wyoming.
Where Matthew Shepard
was killed, and interviewing and doing really what I would call oral history work, and then creating a play out of that that really helps people deeply understand the different people and their perspectives and motives and feelings and thoughts. And so Capital High last year, their theater department, part of their Arts and Production Academy, decided to take on really this very challenging theater production, and recognized that they can't just do a theater production like that, that they really had to prepare and work with their school community and the whole community. And indeed, that's been the case. So they committed to a year-long Erase Hate campaign, and it's focused far beyond LGBT students and community members. It's also looked at women's issues, looked at Native Americans, looked at immigrants, again, across the whole gamut. Unfortunately, that hate can impact almost anyone, right, of those categories. So every month they've had a monthly theme. And then, of course, they are doing the Laramie Project on February 1st and 2nd at Capital High, which has taken a lot of courage on the part of the students who've been participating. In fact, some students have, families have not been comfortable with them participating in that.
Really?
Yes. And so really working with the school community,
you mean just,
and culture.
Just like phobic parents?
Yes, phobic. We have still in Santa Fe families, people who have strong feelings and beliefs about people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, you know, who are different.
I know this is real, but I just, it's sort of hard to believe that people are still holding on to this stuff. It's so boring to hold.
Well, not only are people, you know, adults and youth, they are, and it's hard to believe, and it's disturbing, and that's why we do have Stand Up for Kindness as a campaign that the religious community and the school community are working together on, and that is why the Capital High really, really courageously and with a lot of vision have been working with their students and their communities. And I have to say that, you know, this, the Judy Shepherd event is an opportunity for the entire community to come out and say, we really want acceptance, we want respect, we want to understand, right? And again, not importantly for LGBT students and adults, but also for everybody, because it's about all of us together, as we heard in the inauguration. So Capital High's really taken some big risks. They've brought Judy Shepherd here, this wonderful collaboration, and Laramie Project, and a dance show also dealing with these, it's called Trading Shoes. But again, really understanding, you know, at that core issue that Deborah mentioned, those differences, that just because you're different than me doesn't mean, first and foremost, that in any way I can treat you with disrespect, but maybe even I want to open my eyes and be curious and get to know you and be kind to you, you know, really reach out and create the world we want to see.
When is the Laramie Project being performed?
February 1st and 2nd, Friday and Saturday night, following the Judy Shepherd event, which is Tuesday night at the Lensic.
Very interesting, very important. It's a great play. I mean, just artistically, it's a great play.
And they're doing it in some interesting ways. They, instead of, you know, I don't know, it's, of course, a number of groups have done the Laramie Project in Santa Fe. I think the director of the show, Bernadette Pena's, instead of having costume changes, students are wearing the same neutral outfit. That's correct. Black with some purple on it, and then having to bring out the different characters, of course, through their voice and through their gestures and through their that's quite challenging. So
right, but it's, I've seen it perform that way too, and it's very strong because the action happens then in the mind of the audience member.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, Brandon Johnson, you are bringing the whole religious perspective to all of this. What does that look like?
Well, it started with a conversation in the Interfaith Leadership Alliance, which is a collection of religious leaders throughout Santa Fe, Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and an assortment of others. And really the concern came for our community, and particularly the youth and children of Santa Fe. And how do we as people of faith, people of conscience, create a space in which they're honored? And last spring, almost a year ago, we decided that we would take on the issue of bullying. Because while religious communities are complicated in their histories, at least those who sit around the Interfaith Leadership Alliance table are deeply concerned about affirming the humanity of all people and making space, creating space where the humanity of children, youth, and adults is honored. And we recognize that in today's society, that bullying, acts of unkindness, and acts that are often damaging, reduce people's humanity. And so we started from that perspective of saying, okay, how can we as people of faith, where each of our traditions affirms goodness and kindness and humanity, how do we then engage people in that conversation? And so when we started to ask the questions, the Office of Student Wellness from the Santa Fe Public Schools, we got together and we began to create a conversation and a program around those basic tenets and those notions of humanity. And so I, as a person of faith, and many others say, let's get this going. Let's get the conversation around kindness and the conversation around humanity going and create a space in which people can act in a positive way that right. affirms the humanity of all people, regardless of their economic, social background, racial identity, sexuality. People need to be affirmed and honored. And so that is our approach. And it comes from faith language mm-hmm. and belief.
Now, let's say you've got somebody who's acting out in a pretty nasty way. I mean, being preached at doesn't work, right? What does?
What does work is teaching values, being in conversation with one another, and modeling the ethics we want to live out. Yes, preaching and simply hammering away at something time and time again doesn't work. But living out a pledge or living out an ethical commitment is a way to model that. And so all of our communities of faith are built on that notion of modeling and action, which is great. Which the pledge that we are asking people to sign or sign on to and live out models that behavior. And we as communities of faith believe that that is the most effective way to bring about social change, is to model the behavior and the world we want to see.
Right.
I'd actually like to share our mission statement. You know, that is, it's as well as the Interfaith Alliance, it's also the Santa Fe Archdiocese has joined in our collaboration with the schools. And our mission statement is Stand Up for Kindness is a community-wide initiative to remember the power of kindness. We are asking everyone to join together and take a stand and sign a pledge so we can create a community where everyone feels respected. And our slogan is Bystander to Upstander, to kind of continue to answer your question. Traditionally, what has kept bullying behavior alive is people's silence, that silence equates to permission. And so whereas a bystander stands by and watches, an upstander has the courage to take a stand in the face of injustice, cruelty, and unkindness. And we specifically chose this week to start this in really having a conversation, because the word upstander is somewhat new to people. And we chose this week because Monday was Martin Luther King Day.
Right.
And there's no greater role model for us all as somebody who had the courage to be an upstander than Martin Luther King.
So let's say you are a sixth grader and you see one kid bullying another. What's the model of behavior that you're trying to teach the bystander?
Well, one of the things is when we're talking about taking a stand, we want our students to take a stand that's within their own safety. So they may, with a friend, feel comfortable saying, you know what, we don't treat students like that here at our school. Or they may go get help for an adult. So taking a stand is really on a continuum, you know, so there are many different things. We are doing a lot of assertive training, empowering the bystanders, and we do a lot of role-playing. And just like if you want to be good at soccer, you have to practice.
Right.
So part of the lessons and the bullying prevention work we're doing with our students is doing role-plays, so that they can learn in artificial situations how to take a stand.
Now, do you think that's working?
I think if we practice enough, it can work. ultimately empowering the bystander to be an upstander. If you look at any best practice of bullying prevention, that's what it teaches. However, it's a slow process.
Yeah, I mean, as we all know from observation and from remembering what it was like, the things that you learn in the classroom and then what actually happens when you get out with your kids and other kids and no adults around are really different.
Have I seen students take a stand? Absolutely. And has it worked? Absolutely. But the other part of it, and that's why we're also excited about the community conversation, is this doesn't start with our students. It starts with us and what we are teaching.
Let's talk about the psychology of people who are engaging in this behavior. I mean, Lord knows we see it in Congress. We see it online. We see it everywhere. What's going on? I mean, in Congress, there's real power issues, and it has a lot to do with money and getting what you want and really big actual power things. But in school, like, what's at stake and what's going on in the minds of the kids who really, really decide that they're going to pick on somebody else?
Well, I think for instance, if we look at middle school, where bullying is probably most prevalent, everybody is looking for their social position. Everybody is vying for where do I fit in to the whole.
Right.
And one of the things, I have had conversations from second grade all the way up, and when we talk about why is there so much bullying, every single group, be it second grade, sixth grade, eighth grade, will say, because it makes you look cool, because it makes you popular. And so, unfortunately, the social norm has become somewhat, it's cool to be unkind.
Right.
So we're really having to work on changing a social norm.
And that is tricky because, of course, the social norm doesn't originate in the school.
Absolutely.
It originates in the society.
And again, it's
in Congress.
It's so interesting because your questions are so much about, like, what's going on with the one who's bullying? What's going on? How can we stop that? And it's where the power really lies, is not so much in dealing with that individual psychology or dealing with that individual's values. Again, it's that community that's shifts towards caring and says, we are going to join together, because, of course, that gives them a certain social connection as well. And we, as groups, and we have at school something called Student Wellness Action Teams, and we encourage those students, again, together as a group, to create a different norm, a different value, and to have that sense of belonging together for doing the right things instead of doing the hurtful things.
And certainly in communities of faith, no matter where you come from, you see those power dynamics play out and that yearning for belonging. And so that's why I think faith communities and religious communities engage in this conversation, because we see that flaw. We see that deep hunger from people to belong to something, and the ways when that's not fed, how it manifests itself. And so we hope to come to this conversation with one, an understanding, but also some values to help people understand how they can belong in a positive way.
Do you find that the young people who are really involved with the church tend to be less likely to engage in those kind of dynamics when they're in school?
That is an interesting conversation. I'm going to provide an answer, and then I'll default to those who have regular contact with students. At least the youth at United Church of Santa Fe, I think we try to instill in them a deep respect and value for humanity and indeed all creation. And so when I see them acting with one another, it's in a loving, compassionate, and kind way. Now, that's in the confines of a building and a church and youth programs. And so our hope is, and our prayer is, that they walk out into the world and take those values with them. But I can't speak for how they behave in a gymnasium, on a playground, etc.
So I don't think we have any data to really know.
Yeah.
I mean, I really appreciate what Brandon's saying. And actually, what we do know in general is, young people who are connected to something in terms of whether it's church or the arts or music, who have something meaningful in their lives, are less likely to be involved in bullying, less likely to be involved in substance abuse, less likely to be involved in risky sexual behavior. I mean, we know some general things that build resilience. Young people who have adults who care about them, and that's certainly part of what I think young people get from faith community involvement, is other adults. It takes a village, it truly does. And at the same time, there are individuals, who really still struggle. And so, again, we need to work in all of our cultures, just as I think Brandon works incredibly with his youth around those values, that, we really are working in the schools to create this climate right? Because it is a norm, a climate of how we treat each other. It's not that we'll ever eliminate bullying, but hopefully we can both, you know, reduce it and then mitigate its effects by that the things that happen afterwards, you know. Someone comes up and goes, God, that was the pits. I'm so sorry that happened to you. That was mean, you know. Let's go do something together. One of the less risky ways of being an upstander, right? Not in front of where the bullying happened, but still that caring move, it makes such a difference to the one who's been targeted.
Somebody says,
that was awful, you know. I'm so sorry that happened to you. You didn't deserve that.
I know. I mean, to have even one ally when you're 11.
Right. Right. And even if that ally is in private, even that person texts you.
Yeah.
To just know someone noticed, you know, and cares.
And I think what Shelley said, an important sentence is to hear, it wasn't my fault. One thing I'd just like to say, you know, I think that's very relevant to this, is one of the strategies that we're really excited about in Stand Up for Kindness. And in fact, after here, I'm going to meet with high school SWAT teams. And we're, Phil, who leads our SWAT teams, Phil Lucera and I, are going to work with our high school SWAT teams. And they are going to come in.
And what's a high school SWAT team?
SWAT stands for Student Wellness Action Team.
Oh, okay.
They're students.
We thought it was the cops.
No. They're students who have self-identified that want to really make a difference. And so Phil and I are going to be working with the high schools, and then they're going to come in, and we're going to be doing presentations in all the middle schools, especially around cyberbullying, because they can always have a greater voice and be heard in a way that maybe we can't. And they're also so current around those issues. So we're very excited about, you know, that piece of Stand Up for Kindness.
So there's a lot of events going on, and people can find out more at standupforkindness.com, where they can sign a pledge.
They can sign the pledge.
And if people don't have a computer and they want to call and find out more, they can call 467-2577. And anything else before we go?
Just one thing I want to say is on Friday, people may notice a lot of young people and a few adults wearing Stand Up for Kindness t-shirts on this coming Friday, because there's going to be kindness crews going around our schools and community doing random acts of kindness. And anybody can join in. You don't have to be wearing a t-shirt. And we just really want to encourage everyone to bring that to their consciousness, because an intention goes a long way towards how we act.
And then what we're doing is, when somebody signs the kindness pledge, which is very simple because we wanted it to make sense to a first grader, what we give them is a business card with the pledge on it. And so we're giving people handfuls of business cards, so that when they see somebody just give a random act of kindness in the grocery store, they can just flip out a card and say, hey, thank you for standing up for kindness, and just give them a kindness card.
Wonderful. And
and I just wanted to lift up the unusual collaboration or partnership that is happening.
Yeah.
That you usually don't see between the Santa Fe Public Schools, the Interfaith Leadership Alliance, the Catholic community. The fact that we're recognizing that this kind of social change takes partnerships across the board to happen. And so I really affirm the work of the Santa Fe Public Schools, but also draw our attention to the need to partner with one another to make this kind of thing happen.
Reverend Brandon Johnson is with the United Church of Santa Fe, and he's president of the Interfaith Leadership Alliance. Deborah Bryant is with the Santa Fe Public Schools Wellness Program, specializing in bully prevention, and Shelley Mann Lev is with the Safe Schools Healthy Students Program. And anything else about Erase Hate? Is there a different website for that?
No, except for January 29th, this coming Tuesday at the Lensic.
Right.
Free, no tickets are needed. Just show up at 7 p.m., and really we're looking for the community who wants to hear this very inspiring woman, story.
Being Judy Shepherd, the mother of Matthew Shepherd, who lost her son who was gay in a
terrible
very violent hate crime, horrible incident, but she has started a foundation and really educated a lot of people. So that's Tuesday night at the Lensic at 7. It's free. Thank you all so much for being with us in the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. What a pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ray Marie Taylor. She's author of the book The Land, Our Gift, and Wild Hope. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
And joining us also are Jack Leffler, who's an author, an oral historian, and radio producer, and has been on this show many times. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
And Kais Bello, who is editor of the book Return to the River. We talked to you about that a while ago. Glad to have you back.
Great to be back.
And so the three of you will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. And the talk is called Our Collective Imagination Matters. Three authors share on restoring hope with the land itself. So what's the imagination piece of it? I mean, when we think about all the ways in which the land is devastated, I think a lot of people's minds first go to the kind of political land use mm-hmm. dimension and all of that. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the imagination.
Well, my hope lies in the people and the resilience of the people. And basically, it is we who create the culture that we have or not in relation to the land. And so I feel that the collective, I like that collective imagination, and I know Jack shares very much that sense as well. And I wanted my book to be part of a collective imagination, so that's why I invited Jack and Kais. And I do believe in one voice can resonate within the culture and can matter to many people, but when people come together and express the resonance, I think, really has a chance to influence the culture. So that's really where my hope resides as a writer and an artist, is to be able to contribute to that dimension.
Talk more about what you do imagine for the land and for land restoration.
Well, you know, it would be wonderful to put a really beautiful picture where everything is totally healed and harmonious and there's no more fracking and that kind of thing, but that's not very realistic. So my hope is that this movement, like with the Kavira Coalition, the Malpai Borderlands Group, Jack's Law of the Land, which is really the best for culture and habitat, and the Center for the American West in Colorado, this large movement, my hope would be that these people who are all working together to keep people on the land, to keep the relationship with the land alive and the deep-seated earth values alive, that could somehow grow and have more and more force in our culture, so that there could be less fracking and there could be less loss of land. I mean, land is very fragmented now, but we do know that one thing that comes to mind is something someone was telling me the other day about these wonderful programs for children. I know of some in Taos, I know of some in California, where the children are really very much taken out on the land, are learning very closely about the ecology in a playful way, but also in a very well-informed way. So there's that part of the education for children. And I think the farm to table has many different levels as well, that for youth, I mean, and for older people too, like us, that can be cohesive for the culture. So I do see in my most hopeful vision, I see more water soon. And
you see more water?
More water.
What do you mean?
Because we're dependent on water. And for things to flourish, we will be needing more water. And so we need that from nature for the drought to end. But the drought is perhaps, whether or not
it's not totally going anywhere.
That is not going anywhere. But in the meantime, I had an experience at Comanche Creek when I was helping restore that creek. And as soon as we planted the willows and set up the veins to recreate meanders in the creek, it was amazing how quickly the flow of the water was healthy again and how the silt was eliminated. And so it's a minute thing. It's in a very small site-specific place. But things do have to be site-specific in terms of healing the land. And Kais can say a lot more about the Santa Fe River and the impact on the restoration there. And So I do really believe that if there are enough people working in relationship with the land, for the water, that there can be gradually a new balance that can be created.
Talk more about your, Kaispello, your perspective on restoration.
I echo what Ray was saying about being site-specific. My experience with putting together this book and working on behalf of the Santa Fe River has been profoundly site-specific. It's been something a few steps away from my home that I'm directly interacting with, and, you know, a body of water that's actually running through all of our bodies. It's like you can't get any more relevant to our lives. And that is the starting place for so much of the healing the world needs. The problems we face are profound at this moment, and beginning with what we can actually put our hands on, the stories we can actually tell about a place, our imagination for the healing of that, our faith and our hope is what can bring succor to the hurting, you know, the dry riverbeds, the land that is being fracked, any of the things that we decide to dedicate ourselves to, because it's what is sustaining us as individuals. It's feeding our souls and giving us our meaning and purpose for our individual lives.
Jack Loeffler, you have worked with so many different people in the Southwest and written so many and collected so many oral histories. And, of course, part of the whole question of imagination is what stories we tell and are told about the land. Tell us some of the stories that have really influenced you in thinking about the Southwest.
Well, I'll go back to one of the earliest moments in my time. Back in 1964, I worked with a remaining dear old friend who's still with us named Stuart Brand, who he and I put together a project called America Needs Indians. And the whole idea was, why does America need Indians? And so I lived in a forked-stick hogan up at Navajo Mountain for maybe 7 months, and I was adopted by a family of Navajos. And one of the things that really began to dawn on me in those days, I was herding sheep and guarding the cornfield and stuff like that, and having one of two pickup trucks in the entire region, I got to haul a lot of people around, and nobody spoke any English, and I spoke no Navajo. But it really began to grow on me how much habitat shapes cultural evolution. You could actually see it right there. And subsequently, I'm still working on America Needs Indians in a large way. And so over the years, many years, almost 50 years now, it's been a constant trek through imagination to imagine how our human perspective can grow to the extent that we can accommodate lots and lots of different points of view. Right now in our culture, we're so dominated by an economic imperative that many of us are blinded to the bigger picture. Witness what's happening in Washington as we speak. In his inaugural address, President Obama talked about really focusing on global warming and what I think of as climate instability, and yet we have this big tar sands event coming up right before everybody's thinking right now. And so the question is how much will the corporate will sway our political hierarchy in behalf of creating more money, basically hewn out of habitat, and how much can we shift out of that mode and into a much broader perspective that includes many different things that we have to look at in order to be able to conceive of things. And so my big hope is that, say, looking right here in the watershed, the greater watershed of the northern Rio Grande, which includes the Rio Santa Fe and lots of other tributarial regions, recently there had been a move afoot to try to create the northern Rio Grande region, actually Santa Fe, Taos, and Rio Riba counties, as a national heritage area. And it seemed to me that they blew it by leaving out Los Alamos, because there's an entire intellectual heritage that exists there. And so one of the things that I'm working on right now is trying to look at the greater northern Rio Grande watershed as a place where just about all of the perspectives that are available in America can be seen within this small area, and trying to forward the notion of some sort of sense of cohesion so that people can recognize each other's perspectives and use that interblend of perspective to focus on the bottom line, which is if habitat fails, we're out of here.
Right. We are very out of here. And what you're talking about is kind of like the human equivalent of biodiversity.
Exactly. Cultural diversity and biodiversity are interlinked just incredibly so, just as another huge interlink is climate instability and cultural instability. These are factors that really have to be looked at big time right now. And subsequently, I feel that it's really important for events like we're going to be doing tonight, where we can have conversations with people who can use actively their imaginations in behalf of habitat and seeing us as simply one of the small components of our larger habitat.
Yeah, it's certainly where we came from, is seeing ourselves, I mean, we hunter-gatherers in most of our human evolution, really, as part of a much larger landscape and in communication with the other elements of that landscape, sometimes a very dangerous landscape with full of predators and things like that. And we are so separated from that conversation isn't going on so much anymore. We're just talking to each other, even here over this table, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the spark that gave way for my book was one morning I was in Cerro Gordo Park and for sunrise, and there were these incredible ravens that seemed to be born of the sun that morning. And as they came out of that sun, I thought, you know, I'm one of the privileged people who was able to grow up a lot in wilderness. And by then I knew what was happening. And I thought, I have to witness those values at least to allow them to be active with other voices to come together.
Profoundly in danger, not of losing the habitat and everything. That is imminent and going to happen in our lifetimes. But right now we're facing another crisis of our relationship being endangered, our relationship with the wild, an authentic, real thing in which it actually feeds us. It feeds our art, it feeds our stories, it feeds our collective imagination. Without that, there's really nothing.
The meaning is gone.
We're talking to Ray Marie Taylor and Kais Bello and Jack Leffler. So what are some of we talk about collective imagination and how it matters, and I wondered for each of you, well, you've talked about this to some extent, but for you, Ray Marie, what are some of the moments that really changed and affected the way you see the land and that brought you forward to writing this book, The Land, Our Gift and Wild Hope, and so on?
Well, I guess there are different things. First of all, my childhood in a wilderness homesteading cabin with my family in the summers was essential to everything. Everything I ever learned about the land, about living with the land, came from there. And as I was writing the book, I came to trying to come home again in the 90s and was here in Santa Fe, and I had this terrible shock of what was going on, and that totally galvanized me.
The shock of what was going on, what do you mean?
The loss, a lot of loss of land and the sense of loss of cultural traditions because of that loss of land in New Mexico and in southern Colorado. And I hadn't realized that was happening, so when I came home, it was like, wow. So I was very galvanized, but had to survive and didn't get a chance to get back to the writing of the book for many years. But once I did, I was getting pretty depressed, and I spoke to a good friend in Taos, Ernie Atencio, who at the time was head of the Taos Land Trust, and I said, to finish the book, I need hope. And he pointed me to the Bioneers, to the Kavira Coalition. And it was when I attended the Kavira Coalition for the first time, their conference for the first time, I felt the force of the collective that was still alive. And what was new to that collective of Westerners was there was so much collaboration going on. And that Courtney White and others who founded the coalition managed to create a culture of trust among traditional enemies. ecologists, conservationists, ranchers, federal agents working together all of a sudden. Even federal agents, you know, I couldn't believe it.
Federal agents?
Yeah, federal agents that deal with the land and the...
Like BLM?
Yes, BLM people, yeah. And here was a new culture, a new West, as they say, a new culture where these different factions were actually working together and there was a circle of trust being built in that hope and in that belief and in that actual action for repairing the land and maintaining its health and keeping people in relationship with the land.
It's such a kind of interesting irony, I think, especially when we look at the ranching piece, that ranchers are doing this activity, which is really destructive and uses huge amounts of water and overgrazes the land, which is one of the great problems we have in New Mexico. And they love the land and are a lot closer to it than a lot of city dwellers who might talk about it.
Well, and that's what people like the Kavira and the Malpai Borderlands group, working with ecologists and supporting ranchers who were asking for help and getting ecologists to work with, there's a lot of new understanding of how to deal with the grazing so that there's not overgrazing. And there have been ranches restored, even in southern New Mexico. I've spoken to the ranchers who were just about to kill their cattle. And they finally asked for help through the Kavira and got some ecologists working with them and were able to restore pastures. Tutta Libby Cruz, who I interviewed in the book as well, inherited her family's ranch that was in total disrepair in terms of the land, and she and her husband were able to, working with many people, able to restore the Ute Creek and restored 13 pastures that had been dead and that kind of thing. So
I'd like to mention that, apropos of Tutta and Jack Cruz, that a person who helped them enormously was a man named Bill Zeedyke, who did a book entitled Let the Water Do the Work. He collaborated on that book, and he's a really profound thinker, and he's also a real activist when it comes to putting back together things like ecosystems and Ute Creek. But one of the things I wanted to mention, apropos of what you were just saying about ranchers, one of the best examples of a rancher restoring habitat that I know of is in the case of Sid Goodlow, who has a ranch down near Carrizozo, New Mexico, and who he bought the ranch back. It's a funny way of putting it. He purchased this piece of land back in 1956, which was a cow-burnt hunk of land. And little by little, he was able to restore it. In the 1960s, he was over in Africa, and he met Alan Savory, who has been instrumental in creating a whole new perspective regarding rotation of cattle and things like that. And people like Drummond Hadley and Bill McDonald and Warner Glenn down in the Boot Heel of New Mexico have taken a huge cue from Alan Savory. But the upshot is, and this really interests me enormously, Sid Goodlow at one point was riding his horse through this piece of land that he'd purchased, and he found a petroglyph that had beaver and fish carved into it. And he snapped to the fact that that dry arroyo over there had been running water. There is evidence that there was a pretty sizable gathering of different tribal peoples, you know, going back in time, right there on the ranch. And so looking at that, he started thinking seriously about how to get that arroyo running again, which he did, working with the National Forest Service and other people in the area. Fire is a huge factor in all of this. We have had a history of over a century now of putting out fires as soon as they start up, and that was not right from the point of view of the flow of nature. And subsequently, re-establishing fire as a factor and putting other things together, including talking to Alan Savory about keeping a limited number of cattle in a state of rotation within the context of the ranch, Sid was able to beautifully restore that ranch. There's an interview I did with Sid in my book here, this current book called Thinking Like a Watershed, where he talks about his history on that land. And it was, to me, one of the great inspirations because, as Ray pointed out, there's been an enormous disparity between many ranchers and many environmentalists that extend back to the days of Edward Abbey, who really came down on ranchers and cowboys big time, even though he used to be one, and even though many of his really dearest of friends were ranchers and cowboys. He gave this incredible lecture up in either Wyoming or Montana, forgotten which now, back in the 1980s. Get your elk out of, or get your cows out of my elk pasture. And that really kicked forth this whole environmental concern over this. And to me, one of the biggest issues has been to, as Ray points out, to restore a relationship between ranchers and environmentalists, because if anybody belongs in the same camp, it's those two groups.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned this petroglyph. Do you think there was that connection between the beaver and the fish was like when you have the beaver, the water runs better? Like that.
Well,
was
you have water. You have running water.
Yeah.
And he had this dry arroyo. I've seen photographs of it. Sid showed me these pictures of this arroyo before and after. And by virtue of working with the Forest Service to clear some of the debris out of the forest, which is marks the northern boundary of his ranch, and really restoring fire within the ecosystem and rotating the cattle so that it doesn't get totally cowburnt, not all of a sudden, but gradually the arroyo started running again, and the beaver are back, and I don't know about the fish. He would never show anybody where that petroglyph is because he was afraid then that all sorts of people would be wanting to come and see this petroglyph.
Right.
And he wanted to keep it hidden.
What do you think, and this is a question I guess for all of you, is the role of arts in land restoration?
Well, art is a voice, and whatever form it takes, writing or visual art. Here in Santa Fe, we often have activities bringing writers and visual art people together. We've had, with the return of the river, a few events that have really mattered in terms of witnessing the river and encouraging the culture and the people to support the return of the river. So I guess that's sort of a simple answer, but art is a voice, and it's all part of this power of the collective imagination that we spoke of.
I agree. I think that aside from the political and economic challenges facing all of our crises, our water here, the other issues elsewhere in the world, the greatest challenge is actually the failure of imagination that is allowing all of this to happen. And the task of collectively bringing, say, our river back to life in our community, in our hearts and minds, is the biggest one. And it's one that I think the written word and the arts is uniquely suited to. It's actually possibly the only way we can do that. Gary Paul Nabhan has a quote that really guided my work in The Return of the River, which is that to restore any place, we must also begin to restory it. By replenishing the land with our stories, we let the wild voices around us guide the restoration work we do. And I think that speaks to the larger task of the ecologists and the politicians and the people who are working on the restoration's actual, you know, undertaking. Like what's happened in the Santa Fe River in the last few years has been, you know, it's been astonishing to watch how it's been transformed with many, many people participating in that, artists along with the scientists and the hardworking guys who planted thousands of trees.
But and to have all those people talking to each other, I think, is really where the work is these days.
But really the work is having the land talking to all of those people and having each of them guided by a sense of connection and purpose that comes from something bigger than our heads.
Ray Marie Taylor is author of the book The Land, Our Gift and Wild Hope. Kais Bello is editor of the book Return of the River. Jack Leffler is an author of so many books that if I read them all right now aloud, we'd never leave this table. But he's an author, an oral historian, an environmentalist, and radio producer. And all three of them will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock here in Santa Fe on Galisteo Street, an event titled Our Collective Imagination Matters, Three Authors Share on Restoring Hope with the Land Itself. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Great to be here.
It's been wonderful.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.